This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. 40 years ago this week, Lyndon Johnson, 7 weeks into his unexpected presidency, stood before Congress and the nation to give his first State of the Union address. The man he inherited the job from, John F. Kennedy, was moving rapidly from martyr to icon in the American imagination. The march on Washington 4 months earlier had brought civil rights to the fore. There were 16,000 servicemen on the ground in Vietnam. The economy was strong, the country prosperous. But when Johnson stepped up to the podium that night, he launched the country into a new war, a war on poverty.
It will not be a short or easy struggle. No single weapon or strategy will suffice. But we shall not rest until that war is won. The richest nation on earth can afford to win it. We cannot afford to lose it.
The war on poverty was an enormously optimistic enterprise. The goal wasn't merely to reduce poverty, but to end it entirely. Over the course of Johnson's presidency, his administration would launch a blizzard of programs to this end. Job training, Head Start, Youth Corps, foster grandparents, and community action boards all came out of the Office of Economic Opportunity. The programs unleashed both great successes and great controversies. Now, 40 years later, poverty still very much with us. Its legacy is hotly debated. In this hour, we'll talk with those at the forefront of these battles, from policymakers in the West Wing to Vista volunteers in West Virginia. And we want to hear your stories. If you participated in the war on poverty, either in one of its programs or in one of the communities it targeted, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now in Studio 3A is Larry Levinson. He is now a partner at the law firm Piper Rudnick, and he has worked as a White House aide during the war on poverty, and he later helped research that section of President Johnson's memoirs. Thanks so much for being with us today, Mr. Levinson.
Delighted, Lynn, to be here.
Now, Johnson's decision to launch this ambitious war on poverty came really just weeks after the assassination of John Kennedy. Can you give us a sense of what was going on behind the scenes leading up to this dramatic announcement in his State of the Union address?
You have to go back a little bit to the last few days of the Kennedy administration. Just before JFK went to Dallas, almost three days before he left for Dallas, the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, this wonderfully engaging, attractive professor from the Midwest, Walter Heller, came to see JFK and said, you know, we've been noodling around with the idea of dealing with the poverty problem, and I'd like to get started and putting some thoughts together for you. And JFK said, Walter, you go ahead and do it. And, of course, we know then on November 22nd, those events took place. But the very next day, and actually the very next evening at 7:30, according to what I had remembered Johnson telling me, Heller walked into the Oval Office and sat down next to Johnson. Heller, by the way, was a guy that reminded you of Pete Seeger, the great folk song artist. Very lanky, very, very engaging professor who knew one thing about dealing with life in Washington. When you communicate with the president in writing, you better do it simply. And Heller created this style of memorandum writing that everybody's emulated since. Anyhow, he said to Johnson, we've been looking at the issue of poverty in America, and I'd like to get your go-ahead to start preparing the groundwork for a comprehensive program dealing with the issue of poverty. And Johnson at that point said, well, you know, that sounds like a terrific idea, and I want you to go forward, and I want you to get back to me, but I like the idea, and go with it.
How did this fit into Johnson's goals, what he was trying to do or beginning to think about trying to do at the start of this presidency?
Think back. Johnson was thinking of one very dramatic step. He was going to have one great shot at the State of the Union message coming up literally in 5 or 6 weeks from then. And the idea of this campaign or war against poverty was tremendously attractive to him in this respect. Back in the days before he entered the Congress in Texas, in the poor Scrabble part of Texas, he saw poverty firsthand. He saw what was going on with the farmers who really got hit by poverty before anybody else. And he became part of a Roosevelt program then known as the National Youth Administration. And sort of grew up in the program. And each part of Texas, there were maybe 200 or 215 different parts of Texas that had an NYA operation going. And so Johnson, remembering the Roosevelt experience, was really captured by the idea of saying, I may have a chance to really bring this problem and this issue to the forefront of the American people. But what I don't know is, who are the poor? How many are there, and where are they? And I'd like, Walter, you to go out and find it and tell us for the first time, who are they?
And I was wondering, how aware were Americans at this point of poverty in the country? Was it on the radar screen for most Americans?
It really wasn't. If you went back into the Congressional Directory and you looked under the definition of poverty, you wouldn't find a single entry. And so for the first time, there was this sort of compression of the idea that would have to, 4 or 5 weeks later, end up in a as you've just heard, the first State of the Union message, a rather short one, by the way, as far as State of the Union messages are concerned. But it was the focal point. And between the November 23rd session in the evening with Walter, there then ensued an enormously compressed period of activity in which the program was actually put together in its most general form. And it went back to some precepts that were going on in the country at the time. There were some small programs that the Ford Foundation was undertaking and sponsoring. There were other small community programs in New Haven. And so Johnson gathered together around him with Walter a group of some really good thinkers, Kermit Gordon, who was on the Council of Economic Advisors, other councils and advisors, and they came up with a general structure of what the war against poverty would look like. And somebody said, we need a galvanizing phrase. What would it be? I don't want a trite phrase. And out of this discussion down on the ranch somewhere around Christmas came the idea of an unconditional war against poverty, a very galvanizing, pointed campaign and direction.
Why unconditional? I mean, such a huge goal, I would say, such a huge undertaking to think that you could actually eliminate poverty. Did they believe that?
I think nobody thought the war would be over. It was metaphorical. Mm-hmm. It was a beginning to, as any war is, you marshal your resources, you get an objective. And as we heard from the phrase unconditional surrender in World War II, unconditional means we won't stop at it until we're finished winning it. And I don't think Johnson believed it could be done in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years or perhaps many lifetimes. But the point of time came when it was essential to direct the country toward that objective.
We're talking about the war on poverty, which President Johnson launched 40 years ago this week. We'd love to hear your stories, if you were involved in any of the programs. Perhaps you were a VISTA volunteer or taught in one of the first Head Start programs. Perhaps somebody that was involved in one of these programs came into your community. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And you can also email us at TOTN@npr.org. Now, let me ask you, when President Johnson first used that phrase, the war on poverty, in that State of the Union address 40 years ago, what was he envisioning at that point? What was his idea of where that war was going to take the country?
Well, his view went something like this. Over the period of time, as you noticed, the concept was not giving out money. The concept was opportunity. And if you look at the way the organization was structured, it was the Office of Economic Opportunity, not the Office of Economic Giveaway Money. And Johnson felt, I think, from the beginning that this would be terrifically appealing to all segments of society, because as he kept saying to us and certainly in the staff, that it'd be great to get these tax eaters away and make them taxpayers. And that would be a way of appealing to the conservative element as well. So Johnson had, as he would normally think of these in very large galvanic terms, one large priority. And that's the way Johnson would think. He'd take this great leap forward. And around him, in developing the idea with some of the smartest and brainiest folks in America. And I say folks like Walter Heller and Kermit Gordon of the CEA and folks like Adam Yarmolinsky. And that led us eventually to the selection of the man who would actually run the first campaign, the personal chief of staff, as Johnson called it, against the war on poverty, Sarge Shriver.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call. Steve in Muncie, Indiana is on the line. Steve, go ahead.
Yes, I was one of the workers in the war on poverty back during those days, those heady times.
What did you do? What was your job?
Well, I began as a community organizer. My job was to work with neighborhood folks that lived in the barrios and the housing projects around Phoenix, organize them. It was basically an exercise in participatory democracy. We helped them fight things like the city would put twice as much chlorine in the pools around the housing projects than they would in the swimming pools around the rest of the city because these kids were dirtier. And we would fight those kind of battles and the remodeling projects that were half done. And mm-hmm. we would organize rent strikes to try to combat some of those things. These were people that basically had no voice, and we organized them and took them to city council meetings where their voice could be heard.
Steve, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to ask you if you'll listen off the line because your phone's breaking up just a little bit. We had a little trouble hearing you, but thanks so much for calling in.
Sure, you bet.
But I think Steve raises the point I wanted to get to, which is the war was waged on a very local level. I mean,
indeed.
These were
and the whole concept of was precisely that, and that is that what Johnson was looking at was the fact that poverty was essentially a community issue, not an individual issue. And the way to deal with it would be to deal with it from place to place because each aspect of poverty has had its different connotations, whether it was in Appalachia, whether it was in the rural part of the Midwest, whether it was in the barrios, as Steve just said. And the point of the whole exercise was to empower local neighborhoods and local communities to develop their own programs with assistance from the federal government, matching grants and 90% cover your expenses structure to deal with local problems with local people directing local effort.
It's interesting because I think of Lyndon Johnson as a New Deal kind of Democrat who believed in the power of big government to take on these kinds of huge issues, social issues.
That's a very good point, Lynn. And of course, what happened was his concept was we're gonna have to have somebody in Washington that's going to oversee this program. And I'm worried about burying it in one of the big agencies like HEW or Department of Labor. You realize at the time there was a lot of competition within the government. Who is going to control this program? And Secretary Wirtz of the Secretary of Labor said, it's a labor problem. It's a job program. The HEW people said, no, it's a health program. And you could see in the dialogue going back and forth when the issue was raised, well, how are we going to organize ourselves? The consensus was if you're going to do it, you're going to have to set up your own agency right under the nose of the president, which in effect would be the counterpart to hundreds of community action agencies throughout the country.
And not everybody bought into that.
A lot of people didn't buy into that. As a matter of fact, Johnson himself had huge opposition to this concept because at least he got one note from one of his chief assistants, Horace Busby, who kept saying, Lyndon, you're going to lose the middle class if you do this. You know, you don't need a program for the poor. You need a program for the middle class. That's where the votes are. Johnson came back and said something very interesting, and I hope everybody reflects on this. And that is, he said, 35 million poor in America don't have a single lobbyist. The motor companies have them. The telephone companies have them. I'm going to be the lobbyist for the poor. And they're going to get a voice through me in the Congress. And that's why I'm going to send this bill up. And so the answer to your question was, it was radical at the time, almost revolutionary, to empower these community action agencies, which is really the heart of the OEO program. If you look at it, the way it was structured, community action was the heart of the program.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about the war on poverty, and we'd like to hear from those who participated in the many programs launched 40 years ago by President Johnson's State of the Union address. Did you volunteer for VISTA or go through the Job Corps? If you worked on a community action program or just watched what they did in your neighborhood, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Our guest in Studio 3A is Larry Levinson, who served as an aide to President President Johnson during the war on poverty. And we have a number of people on the line. So let's go to a caller. Let's take first Edward in San Francisco. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was a VISTA volunteer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I worked for a community action program. I was a law student. I went involved in a bail release program, an OR program. We would release people from bail that were indigent. And we were very successful in lowering the recidivism rate. The experience influenced my entire life. I worked for VISTA until Reagan closed it in the 80s. I continue to work. I'm now a union activist. I'm a president of the American Federation of Government Employees in the United States Department of Education. I endorse these programs. They did give power to people. The community action programs were successful, but they were strongly opposed by conservative politicians.
Edward, I'm curious, how old were you when you first went into VISTA?
21.
And how much did you know about poverty in this country? Was your experience with poverty your first experience in the VISTA program?
I had lived in a mill village in North Carolina as a child, and I knew that there were lots of poor children, but I was not poor. And when I got out of college, by the time I got out of college, I had been involved in both civil rights and in anti-war demonstrations. And I wanted an alternative to going into the military service because I felt at that time in 1967 that the Vietnam War was wrong. And VISTA offered me that opportunity. Once I got into VISTA, I went through a great political and sociological change in terms of how I viewed the economic situation and race.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Edward. I wanted to ask you, Larry Levinson, Edward raises the point, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about this. The whole idea of empowerment, of empowering people, came right out of this war on poverty. It really was unheard of before that, the idea of empowering the poor to take on some of these issues themselves.
No, I think that's right, exactly. And that, I think, was the cornerstone of the program. If you're going to solve the problem of poverty, you can't do it from Washington. You really need to deal with it at the local level, as we heard from the two call-in folks just a little while ago. The experience that they went through were all at the very local level. One had to deal with a bail problem. One dealt with a swimming pool. These are the kinds of day-to-day life activities that go on that can only be dealt with when you're down, as Johnson said, in the trenches. And I want to make one point, and that is how Johnson managed to get this bill through the Congress. And I think when we get to a point where you want me to talk about that, I'll do so. But just to let you know that Johnson, every day from the time that he went to the State of the Union and announced this program, every day began to monitor the progress of his bill before the Congress, very impatient to get it out, to move it. And as you know, you issue a very broad statement of the State of the Union, then it takes you a month at least to put the program together. Then you have to go back again, as Johnson did in February, to announce the program in more detail. And then the war in the Congress really began over the fate of the poverty program. And Johnson did an absolutely spectacular thing by looking for a leader to run the program in the Congress. And because of his great knowledge of the process, he settled on a very conservative Democrat from Georgia, a man named Phil Landrum, whose name was anathema to the labor movement because he was one of the authors of the Griffin-Landrum bill, which was seen as a very anti-labor matter. But Landrum took on the lead, as Johnson persuaded him to do so, as a conservative Democrat from the South, saying the time has come to deal with this problem. And overcoming opposition and very furious opposition, the president day-to-day monitored the progress of this bill coming out of the committee. And there was a point in time where the bill was stuck. And the Rules Committee, which is the committee that allows bills to get to the floor of the House, was ruled over by a great patriarch named Judge Howard Smith, who was a sort of an ornery guy who wouldn't let any of these measures through. And Johnson just hit the wall, got on the phone, and one of the great moments in the tapes, if you go back to it, was his lambasting of Carl Albert, this little head of the House of Representatives, the Democrats, saying, Carl, I got to get this bill through. If I don't get it through, we're all never going to do a damn thing in this world. And it's my biggest program. I don't care if I get anything else out. I want that bill through. And that exhortation really emboldened Albert. Bill got moved through. And as you know, the president signed the bill in August. So look at the compression of time. State of the Union, January, message, February, bill signing in August.
Well, one of the famous images of the war on poverty came when President Johnson, on a tour of Appalachia, climbed onto the porch of a rundown shack in Kentucky and talked with the family there about the desperate conditions in which they lived. The plight of the region's residents stands out strongly in the words of a coal miner who was interviewed for a PBS documentary on the war on poverty. He was describing his life before the war on poverty and the necessity of his government check.
If I didn't get this, I'd starve to death. Can't even buy shoes for them, nothing else. I got some barefoot and everything else. You work in these mines, make $4 a day, you can't live on that. I made $16 one week, six shifts, working 12 hours a shift.
But the war on poverty wasn't the first improvement effort in that region. In the 60s, Loyal Jones was executive director of the Council of the Southern Mountains, a membership group bringing people together, working on social problems in the region. He joins us now from his home in Kentucky. Thanks for being with us.
It's good to be with you, and thanks for doing this program.
Give us a sense of what the conditions were like in Appalachia before the war on poverty.
Well, Appalachia has always lagged behind economically and socially in many ways because there haven't been jobs here as there have been elsewhere except in coal mining. And, of course, with the United Mine Workers of America, a lot of coal miners did make good money for a time. But in the early 60s, things were very bad, and we lagged 40 or 50% behind the nation in income and that sort of thing. And a lot of people were hungry and simply did not have the means to buy the things they needed.
And did it bring visible change to the region?
Well, I think it did. Of course, as Larry has pointed out, it was a program to try to get citizens to work on problems within their communities, and not a direct money program to people. Although a lot of local people got jobs as organizers or in doing various programs that came along in the war on poverty. But mainly, this was an effort to try to involve the poor in their own behalf and to have them grow along with whatever programs came along.
And did that work? I mean, did people take to that? Did they?
Oh, yes. It called people's attention to great problems. It got them involved, and I think it, in a way, if I can use the word, radicalized people to accept the need to do something about poverty at that time. And a lot of people who were involved in the war on poverty later got involved in other kinds of programs like Kentuckians for the Commonwealth and Save Our Cumberland Mountains that at first were involved with mining and strip mining and the environmental devastation, but also with fair taxing of minerals and other such things. But it went on to become involved with all issues. Kentuckians for the Commonwealth is one of the most effective organizations in getting legislation to control strip mining, to tax the minerals properly, to limit the mining of property under the old broad form deeds, which formerly the surface owner had no possibility of controlling.
So you still see the effect of going on?
I still see the effects of it, because a lot of people came up who were involved in the programs who are now working toward all kinds of beneficial things in here in Appalachia. And, of course, things are a lot better than they were then. We're lagging maybe 20% behind the nation rather than 50%. And it is true that we have a lot of low-wage jobs with the decline in the numbers of miners and people working in factories, because we've lost a lot of jobs to foreign countries in recent years.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Loyal.
You're welcome.
Loyal Jones founded the Appalachian Center at Berea College in Kentucky. He joined us from his home there. One of the most beloved projects launched during the war on poverty is the Head Start program, which today continues to provide early childhood development programs for low-income families. Head Start wasn't even mentioned in Johnson's original plans for the war on poverty. Instead, it grew out of a desire by administrators in the Office of Economic Opportunity to make sure the war contained early childhood development. Polly Greenberg worked on Head Start at the OEO during the early days of the War on Poverty and was in charge of setting up the program in 7 southeastern states. When she encountered staunch opposition to the program in Mississippi, she quit the government and spent the next 2 years establishing Head Start in the state. Her book, The Devil Has Slippery Shoes, described that struggle. She joins us now from her home in Washington, D.C. Good to have you with us.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Let me ask you, when you first approached the state of Mississippi about setting up Head Start, how much resistance did you get? What was the response?
Well, the governor told me that he wasn't going to have any program for darkies in his state to begin with. That was one thing. And, you know, it was the time when Medgar Evers had been murdered 2 years before, and the three kids, Schwerner, Cheney, and Goodman, had been murdered 1 year before and buried in the dam. This was a time when the whole state belonged to the supremacists, the white supremacists, the segregationists, and they controlled everything.
Now, Head Start was part of was one of the community action programs, and is that correct?
Yeah, Head Start was created within the community action.
Now, maybe you can explain what that meant on the ground level. I mean, how did you begin to shape that program on a local level?
Well, our Head Start in Mississippi, the Child Development Group of Mississippi, was fairly different from all other Head Starts in the country in that we were very influenced by the community action concept, which Larry Levinson has just described, and President Johnson's concept of mobilizing poor people in their own behalf, helping people have opportunity. We saw this as, how do you help poor children? You help their families not be poor. That's how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you do that? Bring them information, bring them opportunities, bring technical assistance, and, you know, the children benefit from this as well as from any direct program and services, of course.
Now, as we said before, this was really a new idea, this whole idea of empowerment. How did you see that affecting people as you explained it to them that way? We're trying to give you power to change your lives. How did people respond to that?
Well, I think I have to back up a little for it to make any sense. When I was still at the War on Poverty headquarters in Washington, I was getting a few applications from Mississippi, but very few. It was from powerful political leaders like Senator Eastland's people and Senator Sparkman of Alabama's nephew. And then there were a couple of very brave school superintendents who were taking a huge risk to use the white school for white teachers who needed a summer job and all black children and a black maid in every classroom. That's how they dealt with integration. There were only a few of those. So this was nothing about empowerment of the poor. And me coming from the community action program background, you know, I understood that what Head Start was supposed to be was mobilizing the middle class community in behalf of the poor,
uh-huh.
I think doctors and dentists and everybody, but especially mobilizing the poor community itself, organizing people. So I went to the various groups that had been working in Mississippi on that sort of thing. They were the American Friends Service Committee, the Delta Ministry of the National Council of Churches, various civil rights groups. I said, you know, you guys work in community organizing. You've been trying to get people to register to vote and work on problems in their communities, their little hamlets, crossroads communities. So, you know, you should be involved in this new program.
So it was really empowering the community in a wide kind of way. Let me just remind our listeners, Polly Greenberg, that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And, Polly, if I could, I'd like to take a call now from a listener in Wake Forest, North Carolina, Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, Laura.
I was, I believe, one of the earlier people to attend Head Start. I attended Head Start, I think, in 1973 in Bristol, Tennessee. And I have a question, actually two questions. One is, I have an older sister who's 20 months older and a younger brother, 12 months younger. Neither of them were chosen for Head Start, but I was, and I don't know how I was chosen. My second question is, I'm an ordained minister now, and I wonder, where are all the other children who attended Head Start? What are they doing? Are they still poor?
Polly, do you?
Well, I'm not an expert on modern day Head Start so much as on its origins and its early years and what it was meant to be and all that. But I can tell you that the National Head Start Association, which is parents of Head Start Children, has wonderful statistics and information and stories about real people who really either moved into the middle class or did something remarkable one way or another. So, you know, there were many wonderful success stories. And I can tell you that my cardiologist was a Head Start child.
Oh, that's interesting. Laura, did you have a second question, Laura, did you say?
That was, how was I chosen? My brother and sister were not chosen. We all grew up in the same poor family.
Do you know anything about that, how kids were chosen?
I don't know that. That's a local decision that somebody made in your community.
Overall, Laura, I'm curious to hear your own feeling about your participation in the program and how it did or didn't help you.
Well, it's hard to say, but I think that one of the things I may have gotten from it was that in Head Start, I was able to attend class or go to Head Start with people who were like me, and that may have helped me to identify with the other children better, because later I was bused to a rich kid's school, and no one else was like me, mm-hmm. and I just remember feeling very alienated then, but I somehow knew that I could do it.
And was there a difference in your life as opposed to your siblings who didn't get into Head Start?
No, I don't think so, actually.
Okay. But you do see ways in which it was helpful to you.
I think it's a great program, and I know it benefited my mother because she had a place for me to go.
Okay, thanks so much. All right, and Larry Levinson, you wanted to just make a point.
Just make a point about Head Start. You're quite right. Head Start came a little bit later off the job programs, and it was the result of a wonderful task force put together that Johnson had organized by a professor, another one of the wonderful members of the academic community that contributed to the Great Society. His name was Professor Bronfenbrenner, if I have it right, who came up with the idea that if you intervene early enough in a child's life, if you put a minimal amount of investment into a Head Start program, you'll have immense savings later on in terms of quality of education, lower medical costs. And from the standpoint of looking at Head Start and its continuing vitality, it has proven to be one of the really enduring and great legacies of the Great Society.
Okay. Polly Greenberg, I want to thank you so much for being with us today on Talk of the Nation. Polly Greenberg helped to start Head Start in Mississippi. When we come back, we'll be talking about the legacy of the war on poverty. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. We want to finish up our hour on the war on poverty now by looking at the legacy of President Johnson's ambitious social programs. Obviously, the war didn't achieve its greatest goal, eliminating poverty altogether in this country. But overall, would you judge it a success or failure? Join the conversation. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Ronald Reagan once said to reporters in an aside that in the 60s, we waged war on poverty and poverty won. For conservative thinkers, the Great Society started a number of disturbing social and governmental trends. With us now from his home in New York City is Myron Magnett, author of The Dream and the Nightmare, The 60s Legacy to the Underclass. He's also the editor of Manhattan Institute's City Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
What's your assessment of the legacy of the war on poverty?
Well, I think that it turned out to be a disaster for the nation, and it's because it gave the wrong message to the people that it was intended to help. Johnson said early in the war on poverty, talking about particularly poor blacks, you cannot bring people up to the starting line of a race and say, and they've been 200 years in chains, and say, okay, now compete in the race with everybody else. You've got to do some kind of extensive preparation for them. At the time when we heard that, it was the true spirit of the age that poor blacks were victims of racism and an unjust economy, that somehow we, the society, the government, had to do something to accomplish this. Looking back on it now, all these years later, one can't help but think that there was a completely unintentional but genuine kind of racism in that belief. That is, the assumption was that somehow blacks were, because of their experience of injustice in America, somehow defective, somehow not able to take advantage of freedom and opportunity like anybody else. And the whole war on poverty was aimed at correcting all of these disadvantages and disabilities.
Let me ask you this. We were talking earlier in the program about the fact that the American public wasn't that aware of poverty in the country at the start of this war on poverty. And I wonder where you think the country would be now without these kinds of programs that were implemented 40 years ago.
Well, 40 years ago, the really great event was the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And had we simply said, America is a place of opportunity where people are left to forge their own success, and there is plenty of chance to do that, we would have had all of the social scientific indicators of black success going exactly the way they were going in the early 60s before the war on poverty began. Everything was looking up. High school graduation rates were getting better. Income was rising, college attendance was up, crime was steady, single parenthood was relatively steady. And the weirdest thing is, in 1964, just when everything should have just, you know, gone to the stratosphere in terms of black success, all those indicators turned around, and we had the creation and entrenchment of an underclass. So I think that had we not in our elite culture said to blacks, you know, you can't do it without this vast array of programs. By the way, you've been so victimized by our society that you need reparations in the form of welfare, which ended up, as we see all these years later, making people dependent and demoralizing them.
Did you see any positive effect of the war on poverty? Do you see anything positive came out of it?
No, nothing whatsoever. It was a big mistake, and the great thing about America is that, as a pragmatic people, we are able to judge from our experience and looking at, especially now that we've undone it with welfare reform, and we see that the armies of children starving on grades that so brilliant a man as Pat Moynihan had predicted never materialized, and that child poverty actually went down after welfare reform, one really wants to say, well, look, the fact is there is opportunity in America, and when people are encouraged to go out and take advantage of it, they do so.
Were you, how old were you in the 60s?
I was in college in the 60s, college and graduate school, so I really am a member of that generation. I'm a neoconservative. I started out as a great partisan of the civil rights movement and was a big supporter of the war on poverty until I live in New York, so I began to look out my window and see the consequences of it, and the consequences in terms of the most awful failure of poor urban blacks was just appalling. And I'd look out the window and see people stoned on dope and begging, and outside my window up near Columbia University, mugging people. And I thought, wait, this was not what we intended. This was not what it was supposed to be about. And how come when we're turning our nation inside out to accomplish the liberation and uplift of blacks, why are things going in the other direction? And that's what turned me into a neocon.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us,
it's
Myron.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Myron Magnitt is the author of The Dream and the Nightmare, The 60s Legacy to the Underclass. He joined us today from his home in Manhattan. We're going to be speaking with Joseph Califano in a moment to hear the other side of the story. And, of course, with me in the studio is Larry Levinson, who was also in the Johnson White House during the war on poverty. But first, I would like to take another call because we have a lot of people hanging on. And let's go to Anne in Lansdale, Pennsylvania. Hi, Anne.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Well, I've been listening to your other callers, and the biggest difference I have from them is that I was one of the poor people, and my family were we were the working poor, that now we call the working poor. My mother lost her job when she was 50 years old. This is in the 60s. There was, you know, that was back when she could go in and people would say, oh, you're too old for us to hire now. You can't do that now, but you could then.
Mm-hmm.
Anti-poverty program gave her a job. It changed her life. She was a woman who grew up very poor. She was bright. She had no education in the anti-poverty program. She felt she had a purpose. She went out. She helped other poor people. Her job was to actually go out into the community, and she would interview people, especially a lot of older people who were too proud to ask for help.
How did she find out about it? How did they reach out to her and find her, and how did she find them?
Oh, well, there were lots of ways. I mean, sometimes it was the ministers in the area, because they worked, and they broke rules all the time, too. They weren't really supposed to talk to the ministers, but they did, you know, because they knew that was a way to find out. They found out from neighbors. They were, all the people in her office, except for the person who ran her office, who was an actual graduate social worker, were people from the neighborhood. They knew the neighborhood. And most of them, this was the best job they had ever had.
So it wasn't just a job, it was also a fulfilling kind of job.
A fulfilling job. My mother went and got her GED. She went and took classes. By the time she retired, she was the administrative head of that job office. I mean, she was a success story in her 50s. She's been an inspiration for us.
That's great.
So the idea that it didn't have, I mean, I know this is a personal story. It did have good effect. I heard you're the last caller. I won't even go into my thoughts on what he had to say. But it did have effect. Giving people opportunity helps them. My mother's life changed. She went from a dispirited, just despondent 50-year-old woman who thought her life was over, she was never going to get a job again, to somebody that felt she was helping. And by the time she retired, and it also gave her a pension, too. So she was more successful for her whole life, and she enjoyed her life.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Anne. That was a fascinating story. We are talking about the 40th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty and its legacy. Was it a success or a failure? We're hearing some different points of view. And you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I know Larry Levinson, who is sitting here in the studio with me, you'd like to make a comment on some of the calls you just heard.
I think what you heard, and it's just thinking back, you know, 40 years ago when all this started, sort of heartens all of us who were really in the front lines then in the Congress and with the communities to saying that, you know, something did finally work. And I won't again comment on the neoconservative point of view. I don't think it's appropriate right now, except to say that he ought to be thinking of this in exactly the opposite terms that he's projected. It was not a dole program. It was not a handing out of money. The essence of it was very, very much in the spirit of conservatism, which is to create an opportunity and let people grow themselves through the provision of opportunities.
All right, we have one more guest we want to get into this program. We've packed it with many people and fascinating callers. But with us now is Joseph Califano. He was Johnson's top domestic aide during the War on Poverty. He's now the head of the Center on Addiction and Substance Abuse at Columbia University and joins us from their offices in New York City. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Califano.
Nice to be with you.
And I think you and Larry Levinson worked together during
a long time. We lived together.
Well, how would you assess the legacy of the War on Poverty?
Oh, I think it has to be recognized as a success. And I might start by making the simple and obvious point that when President Johnson took office, more than 20% of Americans were living below the poverty line. When he left office, only 13% were there. And that's number one. Number two, remember, people tend to say, oh, God, the welfare program. The welfare program was not one of the Lyndon Johnson's anti-poverty programs. Indeed, and I quote his words, in 1967 he said, the welfare system in America is outmoded and in need of a major change. And he asked Congress, and I quote again, to create a work incentive program, incentives for earning, daycare for children, child and maternal health, and family planning services. Now, it took 40 years before Congress finally decided to do that. But as Larry just said, the whole concept of the poverty program and the related programs were to give people a hand up, not a hand out. So, and it can't just, it's not just OEO and the Office of Economic Opportunity. You have to remember, it was the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It was the college grants and loans, which before those, which were the first time they were extended beyond the GI Bill. And today, mean, 60% of the kids in college today are there on grant and loan programs that were part of the Great Society.
Well, I was going to say, the war on poverty really sort of segued into the Great Society, didn't it? Was it all of a piece?
It was all of a piece. The war on poverty in the context of the Office of Economic Opportunity was really the experimental laboratory. It was where we had the community action agencies, where Head Start started. Head Start, now a million kids a year go to Head Start. And the other pieces of the program, you know, were the community health centers, Medicare and Medicaid. I mean, Medicare and Medicaid were the driving force in increasing life expectancy in this country, in changing, I mean, dramatically. You know, just another poverty example, but, you know, when Johnson took office, 26 kids died out of every 1,000 live births in this country. 26. When Johnson left office, it was down to 12. And since then, we've only moved it further down to about 7.3. There were dramatic changes across the board.
And one other thing, and that is, beyond the kinds of changes you've already mentioned, the actual tangible changes in people's lives in terms of poverty and that sort of thing, what about the way this changed American thinking politically and socially?
Well, I think it had an enormous impact. First of all, nobody ever talked the way he talked about poverty. I mean, he took poverty out of the closet and really put it into the face of people. And the attitudes of people began to realize that if this was going to be a country where everyone would have opportunity, then you had to give everyone the tools. And what those programs did was basically give people what most people like you and me and Larry got from our mothers and fathers: some health care, housing. The last major housing act was the Housing Act of 1968, which was part of those programs. Housing, education. The kinds of things that poor people did not get from their mothers and fathers, and that's what enabled them to stand on their own two feet. We have a black middle class. We never had a black middle class in this country. We would never have had it without those programs. And the Civil Rights Acts were designed to say, okay, if we give you the skills, we're also going to make damn sure that the doors are open so you can use them, so you can get a job.
All right. So thanks so much, Joseph Califano, for being with us. It's been a fascinating discussion. And thank you so much, Larry Levinson. Both Larry and Mr. Califano worked in the Johnson White House during the war on poverty. Thanks to both of you for being with us. In Washington, I'm Lynn Neary, NPR News.